part two, land, sea, and air. You know, this is a much more informal discussion. Anybody has questions at any point, just pop up.
Turn on your mic.
Is the mic not on? Check, check, check. 1, 2, 3.
Is this thing on?
quick question.
Yes.
Does FMOD stand for anything? FM, I thought it was FM.
It does.
Modulation or something. But.
Well, it was actually. FMOD was an opcode for audio at one point. The company that makes it is called Firelight, so the F is Firelight. Firelight Music and something development of mine, I can't remember what it is. FMOD.
Close enough.
You know, it's funny because there was a guy named Brian Schmidt who used to be the audio architect for Xbox who said he was going to show up here today and not here. And it's funny because I wanted to give him some shit because he kind of didn't really dare me to write this program, but it was kind of after a conversation I had with him that I wrote this program. So he was saying that, you know, just adding a soundtrack to somebody else's program isn't as interesting to an employer as writing the thing from scratch. So to really flex my programming chops, I wrote this thing from scratch. All the animation and the code and everything, design and etc. I discovered half somewhere along the way that doing animation sprites is just as tedious and time-consuming as editing audio files. It's really kind of interesting. So the point of this operation is this. So the secret Yanni technique, which I talked about in the previous one, which is the idea that you have a background soundtrack and then you play notes on top of the soundtrack that fit the mode. And that way, any time a sound is played, it won't clash. And the trick is you don't really know when a sound will be played, so it has to fit with the mode at any time. The problem with that is you can't change key, because if you're playing if your ta-da sound is in C major and you modulate to F sharp minor, your ta-da is not going to sound ta-da, it's going to sound like, you know. And you know, a lot of times in the mobile world, the soundtracks and the sound effects are done by two different guys, or even a producer just pulling sounds off of a CD file, you know, sound effects library. And so they tend to be very simple and very boring, to be honest, and kind of the same thing over and over again. I've heard it all before. So I came up with this idea of the secret Yanni technique. I'll tell you a quick little story about why it's called that. My older brother is a big shot Hollywood music editor for film. He did Sixth Sense and Untouchables and a whole bunch of those kinds of movies. And I was working on a game for the T-Mobile sidekick, Bob, actually, which uses this technique. And I was explaining it to him and saying how, well, you know, the background music has to kind of stay in one mode and it can't really do much harmonic movement. And he goes, oh, I get it, like Yanni. Now, I'm not sure if he was trying to put down Yanni's New Age music or mine or both, but I said to him, well, yeah, but don't tell anybody. And that's how the nickname got started. So the idea with this game was I wanted to try to do the secret Yanni technique with key changes, so that I could write whatever kind of music I wanted to write and then generate sounds to fit whatever the key is doing. And the way you can do that is with FMOD and these things called music callbacks. So I wrote a game with three different levels, land, sea, and air. The air level is a sprite that is a bird that plays eats bugs, and it generates a melody based on what the current key is playing. It actually generates the melody. So the melody will be transposed to not only whatever key is currently playing, but if the key changes while it's playing, it'll actually transpose itself to the new key. when the bird eats the butterfly, it'll change key, and each key can go to any other key. So the three keys, the C major, or C, E, and A, and there's major and minor scales for each. So you know, if you're in C, you can go to either E or A flat. Or if you're in A flat, you can go to E or C, and either the major scales for the daytime and minor scales for the nighttime. So here's what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
transition. So now we're in A flat. Now we're in E. And after you eat six flies, it changes to nighttime. And minor keys. That one changed key in the middle, right? The melody fit the key change. And of course, the bird is controlled by accelerometer. My graphic skills are not so great that I get that little line there. I still need to fix that, but it's an audio program. The graphics aren't as important. Ignore the little line. Again, there was a key change in the middle. Okay, you get the idea. Ironically, anybody know that little trick about looping ambiences where you take an ambient sound, you cut it in half, you flip the pieces, and then you fade the middle so you get a perfect loop? That worked for background graphics as well. All the background graphics in this are a single picture. I took the pieces, cut it in half, flipped the fast, put them together, faded out the middle, and it looped perfectly. I guess a wave is a wave is a wave, whether it's light waves or audio waves. So in the second level, C level, this is a manta ray plowing through a line of plankton. And it generates bonus notes using a 1 over F or pink noise or fractal algorithm. Anybody know what that means? Okay. So I first came across this when I was in high school, which means it was a really long time ago. By an article by Martin Gardner called White, Brown, and Fractal Music. Martin Gardner used to write a column called Mathematical Games in the Scientific American. Anybody? No. Wow, okay. Well, this article was a monthly article about mathematical games and all kinds of interesting ideas. This article changed my life. This article was like, wow, that's why I got into computers in the first place. And actually, the very first computer program I ever wrote was a prime number Archimedes sieve program that Gardner talked about in that article on a PDP-10 on paper tape, I swear to God. In this article he talks about generating melodies using three different kinds of random algorithms, white, brown, and fractal, or pink, as they call it now. White noise is exactly that, just totally random. And when you play notes in a totally random style, it sounds exactly like noise. I mean, after a while, it's just like, I'm not hearing a melody, it's just random notes. Brown music, or Brownian motion, is where that comes from, is an algorithm that is kind of halfway between completely ordered and disordered. And it's the motion that paramecium use, and look at microscopic, and that's why it's called Brownian motion, because Brownian was a scientist who discovered this. And the way you generate a Brownian motion is, it's also called a drunkard's walk, if anybody's heard that. So I'm at point A, I choose a position at random from there, and I move to that point. And then from there, I choose another direction at random, and I move there. And from there, I choose another direction. So it's not like I'm just moving anywhere on the map. I'm moving from here to here to here to here to here. And the trick about a drunkard's walk is that eventually you'll fill up a plane. But you don't know how, and it's a random way of doing it. This creates some interesting musical stuff, because it's kind of ordered, but you don't really know where it's going to go. But most interesting is the fractal music. And this There was a very famous Scientific American with this fractal picture on the front, which we all know is that kind of, you know, everybody knows what fractals are now. But at the time, it was like, wow, that's a really cool idea. And it turns out that fractals describe many things in the real world, including mountain ranges, motion waves, and all kinds of cool stuff. If you use a fractal algorithm to generate music, to generate notes on a scale, and he describes a way of doing it using dice, it creates music, it creates melodies that are remarkably more musical than either white or brown music. It's like quite astonishing how musical they sound. So that's what I'm doing with this C level. The music in this one is a simple loop. I got really, you know, it's not as interactive as the first one, but the music in this one is a simple loop. It goes from G minor to B flat to C sharp to E minor, and it does that three times. So it sounds like this. Well, they're plankton, you know. And this is not for sale, so no copyright violation. So the motion of the plankton is Brownian, but those notes are being generated using a fractal. And the final level, land level, it's a snake on grass eating frogs and rats. I've got six different terrains, I've got six different music loops and six different styles. The music modulates down at a full step each time, and it's each one is a variation on the 5 plus 5, 6 plus 5 James Bond. When the snake eats a rat, it gets a constant interval. When the snake eats a frog, it triggers the motif of the music loop. But most importantly, when the music transitions, it controls the graphics. As opposed to when it eats the frog, it plays a sound, but it sets a flag saying the next time the music transition back up, it changes the graphic. So this is the James Bond sound, obviously. The snake goes forward at a standard rate, but you control where it is in the flames, left and right. Samba. Thank you. So for that last one, it had to be rock for the rock background, of course. All right. So when I was describing this thing to my mother, actually, a couple of days ago, and I said, well, you know, I was explaining the Cipriani thing, and then I said, you know, wouldn't it be great if you could, what would happen if you could track the key, that the engine could track the key that the music was in? And she went, you can do that? And I'm like, yeah, and here's how I did it. So using the FMI's interactive music system, it does a number of different things. It keeps the audio streams in sync. It allows me to control where the music is going interactively. It allows me to audition the interactivity first so that I don't have to code it up and then listen to it and code it up and then listen to it. But most importantly, it provides what is called segment and beat callbacks. Now, these are, while the engine is playing, doing its thing, is playing music segments, and I'm going to show you all this stuff, it will generate from the engine, usually it's like, I'm up here in the Java level, and I call down to the engine and say, play a sound, and the engine plays a sound, and that's it. But with callbacks, what I can do is the engine is doing stuff, and when it starts a segment in a music queue, it'll send a message back up saying, just started that segment, which I can then read and use to process the code. So I use it in this case to not only keep track of what key is playing, because I know I've set the thing up so that each segment is in its own key. I can also do things like change the background when the transition happens, or I can change the key at a certain beat so that they all stay in sync. So I'll show you how this works. So first is content creation. And I always write out what I do on paper first. And when you're doing interactive music, it's almost, you know, it's funny. It depends on how you're doing. If you're doing a big orchestral score for, you know, a LucasArts game, you don't really care about any of this stuff. Like, just write me a great score. We'll just play it in the background. And it'll be fine. You know, maybe we'll have the drums fade in and out depending on how many enemies are there. But it's usually a pretty simple way. And the music itself is pretty sophisticated. Here, what I'm doing is I wanted to showcase the idea of the Cipriani technique with key changes. So I specifically designed the music in each of the levels to do that. So the first one, I'm in one place, I can go to any other different place from anywhere. That's a much more complicated situation than the second one, which is a continuous loop around the fifth, actually ninth. And the last one was, you know, just different styles. Because what I didn't want to do was for people to say, oh, well, that's great for jazz, but, you know, whatever. I wanted to know you can do this for any style at all. So I write out the music, I record the music in Pro Tools, I dump a mix down to a straight linear mix, and then I chop the segments in Pro Tools to put into FMod. So here's the FMod implementation for the Air. This is the most complicated of the ones in this game. Now, this is actually fairly simple compared to some implementations that you find in console games, which have hundreds of these things. What's happening here is the left side, how much you can see of this. The left side is the electric piano, and each of the cues here is a different key. So the middle one is C, the top one is A flat, the bottom one is E. Then the second column is the bass tracks, and the third column is electric piano tracks. The acoustic piano tracks are in major, and the minor keys are in the electric piano. Excuse me. And the one on the very far right there is the drum tracks, and that's just six or ten, actually, variations of drum track. So let me just pull it up, and we'll play around with it. So there you go. And actually, it looks like it's supposed to look. So here is the music. Now, each of the music, the music is set into cues. These cues, the yellow things, are what the program calls to start the cue. So I say start bass A flat, and it'll start that cue. And in that cue are all these different segments. The green things are segments. And then when I pull up the auditioning console from here, wow, this is getting a little, I need more space. Okay, so But let's, you know, from the game code, I prepare the cue, and I say, play the bass cue. And it goes, boink. Okay. So then I can start the drums as well. Start the piano too. Now I have all these things set up with a key change parameter, which goes from, why did I do that? Don't do that. Which goes from 0 to 2. 0 means key of C. 1 means key of A flat. Now go to the other level. And it'll stay there until I change key again. If I want to go to E, and you can see the ones that are lit up are the ones that are playing. Now it'll transition. Now it goes down to the B. And it'll stop. It'll play whatever the red segment is. See that some of these have red segments. If I hit the stop key, it'll stop playing that one. Go to the red one, and then stop. And then I can do the same thing on the other side. Now there's a little trick that I'm doing there, which you may or may not have noticed, which is I have to hit the thing at the right time for it to stay in sync, because I can actually take it out of sync and it's just terrible. Oops. Yeah, so that's bad. Then it'll eventually go back and it finds what key it is. So you have to hit it at the right time. Now it transitions to C. Anyway. So that's how the music is done. Now the events are done in a couple of different ways. The bird tweeting melody is just a single sound. And I change the pitch of that programmatically in the code, and I'll show you how that's done. The butterfly sound is 3 different sounds played at random. And I re-pitch those depending on what key is currently playing at the same time. They have minor counterpoints as well. So that's it for that one. Do I have anything after this? I'll just do the next implementation. So this is the C implementation. You can see this is much simpler. It's just a basic loop. There's no control parameter whatsoever. Just one cue. Single set of loops and a single start place. I didn't actually show you how that parameter is set up. Anybody interested in seeing how that's done? No? Yes? Okay. This is the music for the C, and it's obviously much spacier and wave-like is the whole idea. And it basically just goes from one key to the next key to the next key. And technically, I could have made this one long loop. Would have sounded exactly the same, but I wouldn't be able to keep track of the key otherwise. So now it transitions to the next key, and
now the program knows what key it
is. And the program will know what key it's in because it'll get a music segment callback telling me, oh, now I'm in B flat minor. And this goes on for quite some time.
Are these segments random lengths? Or whatever?
This one is not. The original one, In the air version, well, I'll just show you the air version because it's actually been interesting. I didn't do that. In air, the way that works is each of the, well, let's just open up one of these guys big. So, whoops. No, don't move the thing. Move the whole thing. There we go. So in the C segment, it's basically just playing one sound or one sample. They can actually have multiple samples that are played in multiple ways. And some of the other ones do. I'll show you that later. But this one just plays. This one just plays one sound. That's it. So that's the loop. But when you open this thing up, you notice that a couple of things. Here it says sharing timeline sync is in red, meaning that it's been set. So this sync timeline is basically a timeline that you can sync all the segments to, so they all stay, they all play the same. Otherwise, you can set it up in different ways so that I can have one music segment play and then another music segment fade into that at whatever time you wanted, out of sync. So this keeps everything in sync. But the way you do this thing is you set the link, which are the gray lines, so that when the link is equal, when the key change link is equal to zero, and the parameters are here, so this is the key change parameter. When that key change parameter, play this link. So what that means is, when I'm in this one and in this segment and the parameter is zero, play this one, and then follow the link back. Which you can't really see here, but it does actually go back to the front. See? If I change the parameter to equal 2, then do this link. Actually, if you select it, it shows up. Yeah, there you go. So if it's 0, do that one. If it's between 1 and 2, play that one. Can you see how it's changing the dotted line? The dotted line means the one I'm currently working on. And that's how you control the music from the parameters. And the parameters is controlled from the code. You'll also notice one last thing here is that this last segment here has a red line to it. That means when I stop the cue, play that one. So don't save that. Okay, and then the last one, land, is a little bit more complicated. I just wanted to show one other thing on the C level, which is the note itself, the plankton note, is just one note. But I use the Fmon echo effect to do that effect and keep it. Actually, the echo effect is in time with the music. So, but I'm only playing one note here. Then I change the pitch in the program using the fractal algorithm. And then in the land implementation, again a single cue, but with six different segments. And each segment has a loop, and each segment has multiple samples in it. So this one plays one of three different samples sequentially. And then when the modulation cue is greater than zero, it'll transition to it'll play. So if I'm playing this one. Start it. Hello.
Try that blue arrow over there.
I guess. Why won't it come up? Well, that's weird. Two phrases to know when you're demoing software. I've never done that before, and I'm not supposed to do that. So you can see how it's playing the first one. It'll just keep playing those segments in a loop until I change the modulation parameter. Then it goes to the next one, which goes to the next one. And it'll keep playing those sequences in a loop until I change the parameter again. And go to the next one. And this changing of the modulation parameter is stuff I'm doing in the code. This is exactly what I'm doing in the code. So. Then, in the events, Again, the rat's just a single note, which I play in different ways. But the frogs play six different samples in sequence, one per level. Makes it easier that way. So the first one is the James Bond thing. Second one is just a little lick. You recognize that as the Girl from Ipanema. Anybody? I'll give you $5. Anybody recognizes this one? Philadelphia Mambo. You lose. Okay. And your standard Macam. I didn't actually talk about the different. We'll get there. You recognize that one, of course. Frogs like smoke on the water. Anyway. So there you go. I mean, what's the fun to have doing this stuff if you're not going to have a little fun with it? Right? Okay, so that's basically the F-mine implementation. That's how you do that. And then when you are finished with your thing and everything sounds the way you want to and you check it out a little bit, you go project build, and this will build the program report, the header file, the wave bank, the event file, the sound bank, everything. This all comes out in a bunch of different files, which you then send the programmer who uses them to build the code. So, let's go back here. We saw that. Okay, and so the simple events are the sound effects that we saw, and we export all the data. And again, the multiple samples in a single data-driven event for some of the sounds, most of them are just a single sound, which I program algorithmically. Okay, so the code for this stuff. A little bit more complicated than the original version. I'm going to concentrate mostly on the FMOD stuff and less on the other stuff. I think that's probably what people are mostly interested in. The main activity of this game is controlled by the Android Manifest. Now, the Android Manifest is a kind of high-level control file for that lets Android deal with all the little resources, all the bits and pieces of the game code. The thing that's most interesting about, from our point of view, is that the APK file that gets exported when you do the final version is 22 meg, contains all the sample data, but you can't access the sample data from the archive. You have to copy the data out to the SD card, and that's what the menu does. It also initializes the engine and fires off each level depending on how you Actually, I'm going to just show some of this code, just so you get an idea of what I'm talking about here. So basically, this is all the FMOD code, and you know, it's like on when you're this is the first part about here is dealing with the buttons. When you push the button, it's listening. Did you click a button? Did you click a button? Did you click a button? And when it does click a button, it fires off the level that you asked for. The most important part is here. When you start the program, it goes to the asset manager and gets the assets from the file, gets the SD card, and then copies the file out. Now, the trick is that I only do this if the file's not there. So this happens only the first time you run the program. You install the program, you run it, and expand the files out into memory. That takes about a minute. So the first time you run it, it's like you're sitting there looking at it, why isn't this doing anything? And you know, if I were a better, I had more time, I would, for this first thing, I put up a screen saying, please wait, I'm downloading stuff. But it's a demo, so whatever. The first time you download it, it'll just wait a second. But the next time, it just comes up almost immediately. And there you go. Okay, so then each activity, an activity in Android is a screen basically. Each screen is its own activity, and so I have three activities: one for land, sea, and air. And the screen is called a surface, and the surface is where you draw, do all your draws and stuff. So that each of these guys is basically a control program for the animation code, and it draws the surface. It also makes calls to initialize the audio and animation for each level and sets the media path. So we saw that in the other code. So let's just look at the LSA Air. So this is LSA Air class. It's an activity. It controls the game Fred, which is the thread that runs in the background that does all the processing. The first time it's played, it does it fires its FMOD init audio. It sends the media path down to the FMOD layer, which initializes the engine. And that's really all there is to it. The three of them are exactly the same, except they mix in different services. Now, this is, we don't have to get into this too much, but this is where, this is how you do game coding in general. So you've got a surface view and a thread and a game thread. And the game thread is basically draw the canvas, draw the canvas, draw the canvas, draw the canvas. While I'm doing it, it's always in the background, boom, 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 all the time. And the surface is kind of, here's the screen, and do this thing each time for the screen. It also updates the game clock, which allows you to do your frame rates and keep track of things in order. But most importantly, from our point of view, it also takes care of the reading the accelerometer. So this game is controlled by tipping the thing back and forth, and the bird flies around, and the snake goes back and forth, and the manta kind of goes wherever you want to. I tend to let it just seems to grazing through is more manta-like behavior. But the accelerometer is what controls that. And you read the accelerometer each time you do a loop, and you update the physics and blah, blah, blah. So then the animation code is similar in each level, except it does different things, obviously. The first thing you do is you read all the sprites, and this is where most of the graphic processing gets done. Pretty much all of the graphic processing gets done. Interesting. Right, so it reads the bitmaps, it moves the graphics, triggers the audios based on Sentinel, and cleans up on. So let's look at that. Let's look at this one. We'll do the simpler one. Let's do the C first. Well, that's. All right. Ah, fuck it. Animation. All right. So this is, it gets a little bit codey. This is all the bitmaps for the bugs and the sprites and the. There are 26 different, or 24 different versions of the bird. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, a bunch of variables, a bunch of arrays to keep the variables in, a bunch of flags to tell me what's going on. Here we, a brute force method of, here are the sprites, put them in the map, go for it. Decode each of the bitmaps, decode all the backgrounds, the bugs and the birds. Here's the physics. This is, kind of get a little mathy there, but not too bad. Check and collision. So what happens is each of these sprites lives in a rectangle. And you can, so the bird's here and the bug's here. Is it collided? No. Bird's here, the bug's here. Is it collided? No. The bird's here, the bug's here. Ah, we have a collision. And in that case, so here you would, when the bug gets swallowed, you set a flag and you play the audio. If a number of bugs have been enough number of bugs have been swallowed, then you toggle from daylight to day, nighttime to daytime. This is how you do all that kind of stuff. And the same thing is true here. When a bird eats a butterfly, you play the sound and you change the key. Well, anyway. Then you draw the backgrounds. And this is basically code to, when it goes up and you. Last one, the next one, and then you transition between the two, et cetera, et cetera. Here you're drawing the bugs and deciding where to place them on the screen. Depending here, the game timer tells you how fast your frame rate's going to be. And you determine where the bug is going to be drawn based on the speed going this way and the speed going this way. The speed going this way is a constant. Constant speed up the screen, but the speed going this way is determined by the drunkard's walk algorithm. So I'm here, and in the next iteration I go here, 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 until I get to that point, then I pick another random point, either left or right, and I go to that one, then I pick another one, anyway, so it gives a drunkard's walk across the screen. No, don't do that. Don't do that. Drawing the frame, drawing the butterfly, do the same thing. It has a slightly slower frame rate, and and then I decide if I eat a butterfly, if I eat a blue butterfly, I want to, the next butterfly should either be red or green, or et cetera, et cetera, and I do random stuff there. This was where I got the, this is the most math I did in this program. I discovered this lovely math, 2 degrees, math.atan2, which was a program that let me go, if I'm pointing here, you know, if I'm here, pointing here, turn the sprite that way. It was, I was very happy to find it because I was like doing all this math and I'm like, oh, there's a function for that, holy shit, okay. And then the last part was, you know, cleaning up after this took me a little while to figure out that you had to do this. Nobody actually said anywhere that you had to do this. But if you don't, your program will crash on a regular basis if you do it long enough, because it doesn't, it's funny. Even when I say at the bottom here, what I'm doing is I'm saying recycle the memory used by the bitmap and then set the bitmap pointer to null, meaning it's nothing. Did that for all the bitmaps, and then I do a system garbage collection, meaning take all that information and get rid of it. The trick is that, I don't think that actually does a damn thing. Java is, it's the good news, bad news. The good news, bad news is that the way this thing works is that Java runs on top of something called the Dalvik machine, which is a machine, which is a software written by a friend of mine named Dan Fuzz, who owns milk.com, I kid you not. And it takes care of all the memory all the memory stuff you need to deal with. It just takes care of everything. It does garbage collection, it allocates memory, does all this stuff for you. This is very convenient, because when you're working with iOS or in other, in C++, you have to do all of the memory allocation and cleanup yourself. And if you miss one, it's called a memory leak. It'll run fine for a while and then crash the program. I'll give you a quick example of a memory. The first time we had a memory leak in the T-Mobile Sidekick, it was a special case whereby if you downloaded a ringtone and used it as your main thing, each time it rang, it would use up a little bit of memory that didn't get used. And so after a while, your device would just stop working. It was like, perfect. That was our first big bug. Anyway, so this, it takes care of all, but apparently it does it, I'm telling it to do the garbage cleanup, but apparently it does it when Dalvik says it should. Again, this turned out to be a bug, not with the program, but with the debugger. Because when I plugged into the debugger, it would crash every time. I'm like, what the hell? And when I unplugged it with the debugger, it worked perfectly. So I'm not sure what the story there was. Okay. That's all animation code. We don't really care about that. We're audio guys. So here's where the audio stuff happens. This is all, again, fmodaudio.java is what I call the program that lives between the game code and the C native code. So everything, all the game code calls fmodjava, which calls all the stuff below it. And this is a fairly simple program in that it does a little bit of process. Here's the main thing it does. It does this handler update thing. And I don't know why fmod recommends you do it this way. I do it this way because they say to do it this way. I would prefer to have its own looping thread that just calls the thing every time. That seems to make sense. But this is a handler. What it does is it sends a message to the OS, which can then get read later. And the way it is, I'm using 75 milliseconds instead of 50 milliseconds this time for timing purposes. But it'll send the message, and then it'll read it 75 milliseconds later, and then it'll send itself another message. So it's just sending itself messages back and forth. So it's kind of a loop. It's actually more of a ping pong. But each time it reads the message, I do this C update thing, and that calls the system update in Java for fmod. And that's the most, it's so funny. I did not realize you had to do this until I could not figure out why my first program I wrote with fmod was not working. It was like, the thing worked fine in Designer, but I can't get to it. You know, it's like, oh, you have to call this thing every 50 milliseconds, otherwise it just forgets to do the loop, or forgets to do the update. So you have to do the update continuously. So the rest of the stuff here is just initialization. Initialize the audio in general, and then for each section. And release it when I'm done. And then each one, you know, basically it's like change key. I just call the C levels, C change key with the parameter. Play the bonus sound. The set mode is when I'm checking to see which daytime, nighttime, or transition I should be using. And the rest of them are just pretty simple. Then at the bottom here, this is, you know, really important here, is the load library. This is where when the program starts up, it loads the libraries from the your asset libraries where all the calls are living. And then at the bottom is the native calls. Now, what these are when it says public native void like that, this defines the function being called in the Java native interface. So you define them here, you call it here, and then it goes to the Java native interface, and it does the plays the C code. I'll show you that next. All right. So just main, audio guys. Okay. So main, this is the source code here that we were looking at before. That's all the Java stuff. But here in JNI, this is all the C code. This is where the good stuff happens. So main.c is the program that gets called every time you call any C program. All C programs have to have a main.c. That's where it starts. And at the top of each of these things, you'll notice that I've got this define check result thing, which is how fmod, you do the check result, and if it comes back successful, you go on. If it stops, or if it doesn't come back successful or something else, can't find the file, can't allocate memory, can't do whatever, then that exit -1 on the other, that just stops the process and kicks you out. This is important because if you don't do that, you can totally destroy your machine. It's really quite astonishing what it can do if you don't do this. So basically, what in main.c, I just initialize the system. I get the event system and the music system. The event system does all the sound effects. The music system is the interactive music system. And it's kind of a subcategory of the event. And then that's all there is to it. And then I release it when I'm done. The really good stuff happens in these guys, or the audio for each level. So in this one, let's kind of start in context here. So here's the initialization. So you notice this thing here, the JString media path, that now points to the SD card where the audio is stored. Here I go get the pointers to the event system I created in main.c and the music system and use those. And then here I load the events, the event file for that level, for the air level, which I called LSA2 in this case. Probably should have called it LSA Air, but I didn't know I was doing three levels at the time. And then I load the different events, I load the samples for all the audio, and I prepare the cues. And these are all the music cues here. And then this is the cool thing. This is the really nice part. This is the segment callback. So what I do here is I tell the music system that this function that I've defined in the code, a segment callback will allow me to access information that the engine is sending out to find when the segments are playing, and then I start the program. So each time the thing starts, it sets up this guy here. So this is the segment callbacks, and each time this happens, it sends back these parameters here. It's funny, this user data is very confusing. So each time one of those segments play in the air, one of those little green segments plays, right here, I set the A segment start variable to whatever it sent me back. And I can then test that variable to see which one is playing. And then later, it also sends me back what beat is playing. So in this case, the music system knows that it's in 4-4, and there's four beats. And so it'll send me B1, B2, B3, B4, B1, B2, B3, B4 each time the segment plays for the entire time the thing is playing. And I can check each time if I'm on B3 and I'm in a transition segment, then set the key to the key I'm transitioning to and check the time of day. If I'm in a key that needs to change the time of day, then the next time it comes around, it'll change to minor as opposed to major. And back and forth, toggle that way. And that happens here. Okay. So then, the other trick I'm doing with this system is here, air update. Now, air update is called when the system update is called. So every 75 milliseconds, this paragraph is called. And if I'm playing a bonus and the audio is active, then I play the bonus sound. And playing bonus is a boolean that I set down here. So when the bird eats a bug, there we go. I'll get back to that stuff. I'm going to start with the simpler one first, isn't it? Here, play butterfly sounds. Here it is. When the bird eats a bug. No, I'm sorry. Whatever. It sets a flag saying, play a bonus. Where is it? Play the bonus. Okay, whatever. So it sets a flag saying, I'm playing a bonus. And then you have down here, it's play the bonus sound. And this is where it gets a little bit tricky. So each bonus melody consists of a string of numbers. You can see melody 1, 2, 3, and 4, etc. It's an array of numbers. And the number indicates an index into another array which contains the notes in the scale that's currently being played. So each of these melodies is a string of numbers in the key, and then I basically randomly select one, load it into bonus melody, and then when the bonus melody is being played here, come on, where'd it go? There it is. Here is the layout of the scales. So this scale says the tweet note, that one little tweet, is zero. The rest of the scale is laid out in semitone distances from zero. So the C major scale is zero, C. Two semitones up from that, C, C sharp, D. Four up from there, E, F, G, like that, up and down all the way. And I do that for each of the six scales, C, E, and E, C, E, and A flat, major and minor. Then that gets played every time this bonus sound gets played. And this bonus sound thing gets played every 75 milliseconds when an event update gets called while bonus is set. And the 99 here means take a rest. Don't play a note. And so if it hits 99, it just sits for a second. So that's why I can go blip, blip, blip. So it goes beep, 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 rest, rest, beep, 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 rest, rest, beep, beep, beep. Then set the pitch using the get pitch program or the get pitch function, so let's say let's say the note index is 5, the note index in that melody is 7. I play pitch number 7 from whatever the current scale is playing here. If it's key of C and we're daytime, play pitch number 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Play the tweet note, negative 1 down, so play a B. This allows me to do all those different melodies in using the various keys, in the various keys. It also allows me to, what I'm doing here is pitch offset equals 3. So when I'm in the key of E, play the melody. So if the melody is, 1-3-5, 1-3-5 in C, that's C, E, G, then in E, play it offset by 3. So that's E, G sharp, B, except if I'm changing keys for the voice leading. So that's how when the it was interesting, because if you change the, how do I explain it? If the melody is going like this, and you start it here and you go like this, and then in the middle of it, it changes key, and then you flip to the change, it just sounded weird. It sounded not right. So what I would do would be, if I'm in the middle of a melody and it changes key, continue the arc, but pick the keys from the current melody, and that actually worked pretty well. It sounds a little bit odd, but it sounds much less odd than changing the pitch offset in the middle of a key change. And that's all there is to it. Now, the other ones were a little bit simpler. The C audio, again, the same sort of thing, except I'm using four different keys here, G minor, B flat minor, E, and C sharp minor. And all I'm doing with this segment start is when the next segment starts, just change the key. There's no need to keep track of the timing because there's no sync involved. And then there's all the initialization stuff. Here's the same kind of pitch layout for the different keys. And here is where I like this very much, which is this set of things here. Come back. Okay, this little algorithm here. Damn it. All right, you get the idea. This one here. This is the algorithm that I read about in high school, actually a little bit after high school, that Martin Gardner wrote about in Scientific American in 1978, so a long time ago. This is a pink noise generator. And basically what it does is four dice, and the first dice is 0000. So if the dice are all zero, you throw the dice and you add up the numbers that are on the dice, 2, 3, 7, 2, 3, 6, 5, and that's your number. Then the next time, you use you basically changing the bits up by one. So it takes a binary, counting your fingers in binary, anybody know how to do that? So it's like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? This is how you count on your... So the first one is 0, you throw all four dice. The second one is 1, you throw this dice and leave the other ones the same. The third one is so you roll this dice and leave these three the same. The next one is this one. You roll these two dice, and this one's these two stay the same. You roll this one, and these, on and on like that. So what happens there is the numbers change. Not if you were to just randomly throw the dice for all four bits, each time you just get a regular white noise algorithm. But by doing a binary algorithm that way, it creates a random set of notes that are in between white noise and completely ordered. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This creates, like you heard, and in general, it creates much more melodic content than doing just random. Another way of calling this is called stochastic. I love that word. Well, that tends to mean a slightly different algorithm, but the idea that in gaming, a lot of times, sound effects are randomly varied. That's the only option you have, is randomly varied. And I wish they'd give you an option for stochastic or different algorithms, because it really does change the nature of how these things sound. And there's one other thing which I wanted to mention here, which is really kind of interesting from an audio and musical point of view, which is what I've been calling the persistence of harmony. So when I was doing the plankton notes in the different keys, and I had all the keys laid out correctly, and that all worked fine. But when I would change key from like G minor to B flat, if the note from after the key change had not been in the previous key, even though it was a correct note from the right key, it sounded wrong. It was weird. It was like, that didn't sound right. So if let's say I'm in G minor, I'm listening to G minor for a while, it modulates to B flat minor, and the first note that I hear is D flat, which is not in G minor. Although it's in B flat minor, it sounded wrong. It was like, that does not sound right. And this happened in the other level as well. So what I ended up doing was, if it's the first note after a key change, and that note is not in the previous key change, or in the previous key, change it to one that it was. And that just seems to work. So if it's a, you know, if it was a D flat, I change it to a B flat, so that it sounds, the transition is smoother. And the funny thing was that after, you know, I tried originally doing a number of sophisticated and complex algorithms to determine which was the right key, and doing array searches and checking back and forth until I realized, you know, it's just easier if I go if A then B, if this then that. You know, that's what I'm doing here with the cases. And sometimes when doing this kind of audio programming, it turns out that the simplest way and the more musical way of doing things is a simple if this then that algorithm, as opposed to some complex array comparisons. So that's what I'm doing there. And the last one, the land audio, again, a similar sort of thing. And what I'm doing here is each time a new segment starts, I set the key and check to see if the frog has been eaten. If the frog has been eaten, I set another flag saying the next time, as you see at the bottom here, when the next modulation that happens, change the graphic. And I set a flag that is then read by the graphic code, which is running each time. Each time it looks, plays the background, it checks to see if the flag is set. Flag set, flag set, flag. Oh, the flag is set. Okay, turn it off and then change the background. It worked like a charm. And again, here I have the pitches for the different scales to be used to do the rat and the rat notes, and that seemed to work pretty easily. And again, another situation where instead of trying to do okay, well, if I'm playing this note, then the second note should be a third away, so that's one in the two in the array. But if I'm at the top of the array, then do the bottom one. But then sometimes that doesn't sound good either. Fuck that! It was like play this note, then play this one. If that one, then play that one. If this one, then play that one. It was, you know, much easier to do it that way, and that actually ended up being the more musical result. And that's all there is to it. Beat was in Prisma, persistence of harmony, set on the next background. There you go. So, the point of all of this, there are a couple of things I want to make, which was the debugging C code in Eclipse is really painful. Because you don't get to set breakpoints, you have to write these little print statements to tell you what's happening. And Steve Trinovich, how are you doing? I'm just finishing up. You're just in time. Posting to the Android Market and FMod license. Actually, I talked about both of these things in the other presentation. If I want to post it to the Android Market, I'm going to talk to my FMod friends down at GDC next week. But they're going to want me to pay them $500 to post this for free as a free download. I'm like, you know, so I'm not looking to post this thing to make money, because that's just not happening anymore. But it is useful as an example of the technique and a how-to guide for FMod for Android. And the thing about this technique that I think is most powerful and most interesting from an audio point of view is that it frees the composer from the tyranny of a single mode background music. In the original Secret Yanni technique, you can only stay in one mode, C minor. You know, A minor, C major, you know, if you want to get really freaky, you can maybe play in G or F. But A flat, forget about it. Whereas this, using FMod to keep track of the key changes, allows you to change key whatever, and then change the background or the bonus sounds to fit. Of course, if your sounds are non-tonal, like explosions or gunfire, none of this makes any difference. But if you're doing a game, particularly mobile games tend to have tonal bonus sounds like ta-da or bing or whatever, then it becomes useful. The other side of that same coin is that it requires the composer to work closely with a programmer or have an audio guy write his own code, which is what I've been doing. Usually in a big game, a lot of times there isn't even a guy whose job is to program the audio. A lot of times it's a guy who's programs, the AI, and everything else, and, oh, I'll get to the audio when I can. This is why data-driven stuff works in the first place. But if you can write your own code, you can do this stuff and make interesting soundtracks that you could, that could not be done any other way. Literally, this stuff could not be done without the code. You can't do this data-driven. You have to have the code generate a lot of this stuff. But the main reason I did it was because talking about music is like smelling a painting. I keep trying to explain this idea to people, and they, like, you know, they have no idea what I'm talking about. But if I can play it for them and you can hear it, it's like, ah. Ironically, I'm starting to wonder if I may have done my job a little bit too well in that in this game, everything sounds great. There's no clashing, there's no, you know, whatever. You know, unless you can hear the harmonic change and understand that, oh, you're changing the bonus sounds to fit, it just sounds like nice music in the background. So I'm like, we'll see how it goes over at GDC, which I'll be demonstrating it there next week. So there you go. That's all there is to it. Questions? That was obviously a lot more rambling than the first one. I usually try and write the stuff out so I'm not so rambly, but there you go. Any questions, Steve?
You may have got over this.
Yeah. Yes?
I'm curious on a macro level, maybe, how many people in the world or in America do this kind of work? Is it dozens, hundreds, thousands, ten thousands?
Kind of work.
The game audio programming and composition.
Well, as far as I know, I know a few people who can do what I've done here, which is content, implementation, and code. And to be honest, I'm trying to present myself as a more, you know, able to do more for your company than just do content or just do implementation or just do code.
So in most cases, it's separate?
Most cases, it's separate. And certainly the big game companies, they have, you know, 10 guys doing content only. They got two guys doing implementation, and they got maybe a guy doing audio programming. And when he's not programming for the game, he's doing tool development or, you know, DSP processing, which I'm not really doing DSP stuff. I mean, I can, but I just haven't. But the idea of one guy who does all this stuff harkens back to the early days of gaming when there was one guy who did audio, period. And in those days, you know, we were talking about this, you know, earlier, it's like the limitations were so great that it was really useful if you had a guy who could code. I mean, that's how I started. I got into this industry in the first place. I had been a road dog bluesman piano player for years, literally, on the road playing Joe Louis Walker, the Boss Dockers. And when I got into gaming, I got into programming. I was doing business applications in COBOL on IBM mainframes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, playing music at night. It was, you know, the programming was my day job, right? But when I got too old to be on the road anymore, I got into the gaming stuff because there was this new engine, which ended up being called the Beatnik engine, which was allowing MIDI music to be played on Macintosh platform for the first time ever.
Yeah,
yeah. And eventually they sold it to, actually they licensed the technology to Apple as the QuickTime musical instrument set, which is why I had a job. But the trick was that you couldn't just make sounds. You had to program the sounds into the games to make it sound like anything at all. And the thing I used to like to say in those days was, you know, if a game made any sound at all, people thought it was really cool. It didn't matter if it sounds like shit. If it made any sound at all, it beeped at the right time. It was like, wow, it beeped. You know. And so a lot of the stuff that I did at this company called Hailstorm, it was not only making these little tiny bits of 8-bit, you know, 11K sounds, it was also programming the engine to play the sounds in ways that used space very efficiently. And, you know, the definitions, I have to go in and edit the root note in hex, you know. And so you had to kind of know your way around computers pretty well to do that kind of stuff. And again, as time goes by, the bottlenecks keep expanding and things get more complex. And so the specialization starts to be like, well, the audio guy not only doesn't need to know how to code, he shouldn't code. We don't want him coding. We want him making sounds. And then send the sounds over to the program and he'll deal with it. And then as things get even bigger than that, in the big console games where they have hundreds of thousands of sounds and lines of dialogue, and you know, you can have 300 sounds playing at once on an Xbox game, then the audio middleware situation came in. A lot of times the proprietary, or the companies have proprietary systems like Exact and Scream, et cetera. But the middleware situations came in where you have now a guy who makes sound, a guy who implements the sound into these engines using FMOD or WISE or whatever, and then a programmer who does that kind of stuff. But the days of one guy on a team doing audio, you know, that's gone, except in the mobile world. That's what's happening in the mobile world. The thing I like to say is, you know, you get old enough, you become cool again. So I think some of us on here understand that. The same skills that I used in the early days and doing, you know, PC games in the 90s are the same skills I use doing mobile game soundtrack for mobile games, and very similar sorts of code tricks and very similar sorts of techniques. So people doing this kind of stuff on the console games, no, that's just not happening. But being able to do this in the mobile space, I think, is a valuable skill, and at least I'm hoping that's the case. Anybody wants to hire me to do this stuff in the mobile space, I'm available.
And is it possible to make money in this mobile environment if you're giving away free downloads?
Well, I'm not looking to actually make money with these programs. I'm looking to sell my services to people who are doing downloadable stuff. And of course, you know, the mobile space, again, is so similar to the game industry in the 90s. It's a Wild West, frontier out there. Like, some people are making, you know, it's a gold rush. There's gold in our hills. Some people are making a lot of money. Angry Birds is an entire industry based on that one little game. But at the same time, a lot of people get shot dead. You know, so it's kind of an interesting space in that way, and I like working in that space, actually. And, you know, a lot, this is just the game stuff I'm doing. I do a lot of audio UI stuff as well. I'm doing some stuff for some apps that are very popular, and doing some downloadable content for that, and that certainly can be lucrative if you get enough, you know, market share. Again, you know, when you have a catalog of 50 games, then if it's easy for you to download that game, you'll make a lot of money with that. But now the App Store has how many hundreds of thousands of games? It's hard to stand out. People are downloading Tetris and Sonic and Angry Birds. So it's definitely a Wild West frontier. It'll be interesting to see what the next version of that is. I mean, I think what will happen in the mobile space will be very similar to what happened in the game space, in that in the early days of the games, there were like 100,000 different little companies putting out all these cool little games for Atari and whatever, and some of them made a bunch of money, and some of them went under, and then a lot of them got conglomerated into EA and Lucas, and you know, and they all got conglomerated into these big things. Now there's like five guys: EA, there's Blizzard, there's, you know, a couple of big companies, and they have different studios. But it's basically, you know, big corporations. I think that'll happen eventually with the mobile space as well, in that you'll have, right now you have a lot of little guys doing a lot of little games. A Casual Connect that was here in Seattle last year, there was like, I saw some really interesting stuff done by five guys. And these days, you don't even have to be five guys in the same area. I mean, this one game which kind of had this really cool gravity physics thing going. It was a lot of fun to play. You know, one guy was in Puerto Rico, and the other guy was in Brazil, and another guy was in China. It was like, and they, you know, Skyped the whole thing and put it out, and they were doing quite well. So it's kind of a that same kind of new frontier feeling. But I get the feeling that as time goes by, it's going to be, you know, EA Mobile, which bought Pogo for, and then they bought PopCap, and it's going to be the same sort of thing. You're going to get a conglomeration of guys doing. No, it'll end up being five different companies doing the MOFES. And then the interesting stuff will be happening in the next, whatever the next thing is. So, you know, first it was computers, then it was web, now it's mobile. I think the next thing is going to be wearable computing and augmented reality. I have some evidence for that. But and the same thing will happen, too. You'll have a bunch of, you know, the first few guys who make the first great augmented reality game that you use wearing your glasses, they're going to make a fortune. Then you'll have 10,000 other guys trying to make that same fortune, and that'll conglomerate to, you know, whatever, and then it'll be the same thing the next one, which will be directly to your brain or whatever. Yeah, so there you go. But the real question you asked was how much work is there for this kind of stuff? Certainly there is lots of work in the game industry for content providers, some work for implementers, and a little bit of work for programmers. And again, most of the programmers, I was talking to my friends over at Bungie the other day, and they were like, we just got our own audio programmer. Oh my God, you know, after 10 years of doing this, of trying to squeeze audio functionality out of the rest of the guy, you know, their engineering staff, they now have one guy who's dedicated to programming audio. Woo-hoo! You know, which is one of the reasons game soundtracks suck so bad. I mean, the truth is they kind of all sound the same and they all kind of sound bad. I'm hoping that by being able to, you know, I would like to be able to, you know, to go to a game company and say, look, you don't need to bother the audio programmer to, you don't need any of your programmers to implement the audio. Fucking, I'll do it. I'll do the sound and I'll program it myself. It's not that hard if you know what you're doing. And have yet to convince anybody that's a good idea, but it's still early. We'll see what happens at GDC next week. But there's certainly a lot, and it used to be when I first got into this business 15 years ago, there was no standards for this. It was all make it up as you go along. And there was a lot of work for people who were able to do that. But nowadays you have, well, I just realized I'm standing in one of the institutions that spits out fully, you know, formed, well-trained, and, highly qualified sound designers, you know, 10 a week. And so because of that, there's like a lot of work for these guys, but there's also a lot more competition than there used to be. And I think if you really want to be a sound designer, sure, you have to know all the Pro Tools stuff, and there's a lot of people doing that. But knowing the implementation of the programming aspect, I think, makes you a better employee. It makes you easier to deal with engineering staff, makes you understand what you can do, what you can't do, what's easy, what's not, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, there's a lot of work for this kind of stuff, but it's not quite... You know, it's been changing over time.
Thanks.
Sure. Any other questions? I got off on a little rant there, but
over here.
Yes.
Would you say that now that mobile games are going really strong, that the development process has gotten easier or taken a step backwards from, like, you know, what we do on our computers being super high tech and 3D?
I won't say it's taken a step backwards. It certainly does remind me of the early days. And the trick is what I call resource constrained, which is a nice way of saying you got this much space to do your shit. The trick is in the early days, you know, your entire game for a Nintendo cartridge was like, you know, what, 200K?
If that.
I mean, each one of the files in each of those segments is like five times that big.
Super Mario is
32K. For the whole game, right? Right. So, you know, each one of my files, each one of my audio files is bigger than that whole game in this implementation. In the mobile space, when I first started working with the T-Mobile Sidekick, and this was in 2001, actually, yeah. Right after 9/11, as a matter of fact. In 2001, the biggest size a game could be was, I think, 300K. And that was for all the sound and music and graphics and everything. Actually, the original one was even smaller than that, but then it became 300K. As opposed to the, you know, how many gigabytes is a Xbox game these days? I mean, I don't even know. Those DVDs, they have 50 gig on them. I don't even know how big they get. And you can download more content. I mean, even that's gone away. The next thing is going to be is the DVD is obsolete already, and you just download everything off the web. I mean, you know, I got a BitTorrent, 400, 2 gig, no problem. So it's not that mobile games have gone backwards. It's that mobile games are using the same kind of resource-constrained techniques that we used back in the early days, back in the, PC games in the 90s and the web in the 2000s, and now it's that same kind of, we've only got this much space, what can we do with it? This actually generates creativity, I think. I think it allows you to do things you might not do otherwise because you're, you know, you have to, it's what I call learning to love your limitations. If I know I can only work within this much space, then I can come up with creative ways to deal with that much space as opposed to, the quote I like to use is from Stravinsky, if you don't mind me getting pedantic a little bit, which is from his lectures at Harvard in the 40s, and I'm paraphrasing. At one point he's saying, I actually have it somewhere in there, but I won't look it up for you. But paraphrasing, he was saying that if I look at music, it's an ocean. It's too big. You can't write the ocean. But if I narrow my focus smaller and smaller down to a single pebble on the seashore, that I can write. And the idea that the limitations allow you to focus your attention, I think that can actually help creativity. So I think that's kind of where mobile games are at now. And again, as the bandwidth expands, you'll have this, you'll see the same sort of transition happen and that we saw with the games on the web, et cetera.
Are we seeing...
I will say one last thing about the development stuff. One of the things, an interesting trend that's happening now, which I'm seeing more and more, and again, we have a guy here who wrote one, the problem has always been in the mobile space that there's just so many different kinds of phones, and they all do different stuff, and everybody's trying to be higher and higher and, you know, better and better, but it's like, oh, I can do this on this phone, but I can't do that on this phone, but I can do this on this. It's like, it's insane. And so one of the things I'm seeing happening lately is a kind of programming middleware where I write the game in whatever language I want, C++, some scripting language, whatever it is, and then I run it through my translator program, and it spits out a version for iPhone, spits out a version for Android, spits out a version for Windows. And that, on the one hand, that kind of makes it easier for you to make money and deploy on all these different platforms. At the same time, it kind of stifles your creativity a little bit. Unity is a good example. Unity is a great program. Everybody's using Unity. Oh, we love Unity. Except it uses this kind of brain-dead version of FMOD for the audio. You can't do any of the event process. You can just basically play a sound and that's it. And that's kind of painful if you're an audio guy trying to do interesting stuff in this space. So it's advantages, disadvantages, you know, but not backwards. It's kind of the brave new world as opposed to the old world. Steve?
Just as Netflix is obsoleting, you know, DVDs, and like you're saying, it's getting, are we going to see, or do we see now streaming games where it's just all streamed anyway, there's no need to actually have local storage beyond a certain amount of buffer, that it just takes it?
Well, you've been reading my blog, right? yeah, no, because I have a blog on O'Reilly.com, whatever. If you go to my site, you can find it, called The Annoying Audio Blog. And last year, I wrote a blog called The Myth of Music Ownership, in which I postulated a time not too far in the future where, you know, how much storage you need to store in your pocket? Zero. If you hate in a cloud-covered world where you can have, you know, full band access at all the time, and I'm talking in the subway. I mean, it has to be like solid, right? But that time is coming. As solid as the power is, like, I plug my power in here, I expect to get power. I need to have, you know, once there's a broadband connection that is that solid for wireless, we're not there yet, but once there is, then there's no point in storing any music on my phone. All of my music lives is just a set of pointers in the cloud, and the cloud service is, you know, my music collection. And, you know, I wrote this using pictures to illustrate from my own collection of, you know, cassette tapes, CDs, and vinyl, you know, and it's getting smaller and more and more obsolete until eventually, you know, it's not, there will be no local storage. Local storage is not going to happen at all. It'll be all live in the cloud. You just access it from streams. Yeah. Well, I wrote this article, and I called it The Myth of Music Ownership mostly to, you know, because it, you know, you're trying to get people to read it, right? The idea that, you know, you own your music, it's like, well, I've got a plate of vinyl. I own this piece of these atoms, and the grooves on the thing, you know, can be thought of as a loss leader. I'm selling you a platter. I'm not selling you the groove. The grooves are just grooves. I'm selling you the platter, but in a bit in a world where, you know, streams. Well, now I'm trying to convince you that the atoms are the same as the bits, but, you know, we all know there's not. And if I can just get the bits from the thing, why would I need to own anything at all? Well, I published this thing, and, you know, it's a fairly esoteric little blog. Mostly game guys write, read it, you know, some media people. It is on O'Reilly, so it does get a fair amount of play. And my blogosphere just blew up on that one. Like, I got people telling me what an asshole I was. I'm like, dude, I'm just talking about, you know, I'm talking about what's happening. I'm not, you know, and there was, you know, I got, apparently what happened was it got featured in an ASCAP newsletter, and they just went ballistic. You know, how can you say you don't know music? I'm not, you know, musicians need to get paid and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, yeah, hi, I'm a musician myself. I make a living with this stuff myself. I'm not saying that. But the trick is that, and actually I think that the real truth of the matter is that in a cloud-covered world like that, the musician gets paid out of the subscription fees. And nowadays, it's like, this is the thing with, always the thing about iTunes that I never liked, which was, I can buy a tune from my, you know, something from iTunes for a buck, and I can listen to it 5,000 times. Oh, it's my favorite song, I love this song, I play it all the time, blah, 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 blah. But I can also buy a song from iTunes for a buck and think, God, what a piece of crap. Why did I buy that? And never listen to it again. And yet, both of those artists get the same amount of money.
Maybe.
If they get any money at all. But I mean, yeah. Theoretically. Theoretically. Yeah. This is all theoretically. But then, in this cloud-covered world, you know, the joke I used to make was that the perfect, you know, DRM, the perfect digital rights management system would be that every time I hear a piece of music, somebody gets a penny, right? But a cloud-covered world would actually allow that to happen. So if I listen to a song 5,000 times, every time I listen to it, there's a note in the cloud saying, that guy, this guy listened to that, and then the artist gets paid royalties out of the subscription fees that I pay for my cloud access. Whereas I only listen to this thing once, that guy gets one penny as opposed to the 5,000 pennies the other guy gets. But the other trick is that it's not a per download. It's not like every time I listen to a piece of music, I'm paying somebody. No, it's I pay a subscription fee. I pay access to the cloud. And everything else comes out of that. And I think that really is the way it's going. You want predictions? That's a prediction.
And you may be a big user and someone else is going to, 10 other people are going to be nil users for still subscribing.
Exactly.
So.
And eventually, and that kind of all, it's kind of like internet access now. It's like, you know, if you BitTorrent stuff, you pay the same amount just for access, you do it to, you know, my mother who downloads, you know, a text file and thinks it's crazy.
So what about streaming games?
So streaming games. So I did write a whole blog about audio for streaming games. Now, this is cloud-based gaming. And there's guys who are doing this, the OnLive guys are doing this now, right? So in OnLive, what they're doing is you have a game controller. You send a command to their server. They do all the processing on their server, and they send you back a video, an audio stream. And that's all there is to it. There's no Xbox. I think the Xbox guys are kind of going a little bit nuts on that one. Now imagine doing that, but without the cable connection. Now, what kind of games could you play if you were not tethered to your TV or your computer, but you could wirelessly download all that stuff to your AR goggles and walk around with it. Yeah, I mean, this is where it's going. And so eventually what you have is what they call, you know, computer overlays of the room. So I'm playing World of Warcraft in a park, and I look over here, and I see, you know, you are playing the same thing, but I don't see you through my glasses. I see you in your avatar. I see your avatar moving like you do. Over there, there's a dragon, and he's growling, rrr, and I hear him over there. And then when I turn this way, I've got my ear pods in, HRTF, is that right? Mm-hmm. Follows, and now the dragon is still, you know, wherever I look, the dragon still comes from the same place. But my sword makes magical sounds like they always do in the movies, or, you know, karate sounds, and they follow my hand wherever it goes, depending, no matter where my head is. I think this is where it's going, and you know, I tend to try and keep my predictions to audio stuff, you know, but as far as the audio for streaming games, I think that is eventually where, and that's the AR, that's the new thing. And again, once these things are happening, you know, Google is working on it as we speak. I happen to know that for a fact. Once these things become more prevalent, then you'll start getting a couple of, you know, smaller teams doing, it'll be the same thing over again. It'll be exactly the same thing. Small teams doing cool games. One of the cool games will hit that everybody will get it. Oh, I get it now. Right? Like Angry Birds. Oh, I get it now. It's fun. It's stupid. It takes up time. It's like Tetris, you know. And then you'll have, you know, and it'll be, you know, that'll fuel more stuff and more stuff and more stuff. So, anyway, that's a little off topic from what I'm talking about, but go to my blog, apparently if you type in annoying audio in Google, I come up like top of the list twice. Go to annoying audio, it's my blog, it talks about this kind of stuff and a lot of other stuff. Also contains links to my FMod for Android stuff and a bunch of other crazy things, including top 5 ways to annoy an audio guy, my credo, I promise never to program a computer to play something I can't, and a bunch of other fun stuff. And cartoons, too. Who was talking about cartoons? So, ringtones for electric vehicles. That's a fun one. There you go. Anything else? I think we're good.
Thank you
so much. Can I unplug?